We're meeting in the back of the amateur to order. Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming out. Happy October. It's the days are getting a little bit shorter. The nights are getting a little bit cooler. I think there's still about 7 billion mosquitoes around here, but and there's dew as well. So maybe there's more things that we have to contend with, but at least we have more opportunity to look at the night sky. We've got an action-packed agenda for this evening, but we also have an outside guest speaker who has joined us already on Zoom. So as we usually do in those circumstances, we're going to go ahead and move the guest speaker up to the beginning. And in order to introduce him, I'm going to call on Richard Thyme to say a few words.
Hey, guys. My first meeting, Sean did a presentation on Novus and the Blaze Star that I found amazing and really wanted to see something similar for you guys for my passion in astronomy, which was gravitational wave astronomy. First learned about it with my professor at University of Florida Optics professor. He showed us the test bench for the stuff he developed for LIGO. And that's when I first heard about it, 2008. I actually sent him an email in 2016 when they finally announced the detection of the first gravitational wave. 10 years ago, last month, was when they actually made the detection, and but they took their time announcing it. And sent him an email. He's from Austria, so I heard this in his Austrian accent. He said that that people around the campus were asking to take selfies with him. He felt like a rock star. And one long after that they gave him the Nobel Prize for it. So to give a presentation on gravitational wave astronomy, we've got Dr. Michael J. Zevin. He's the astronomer at the Alder Planetarium in Chicago. And he's also the, I hope I get this right, Sierra Visiting Scholar at Northwestern University, where he got his PhD. I am not capable of getting this to notice.
Thanks for the introduction. And how long do these lectures usually last? Is it 30 minutes, 45 minutes? I'll adjust accordingly.
Hey, Dr. Zevin. Yeah, either of those is fine. We normally look in the somewhere between 30 minutes to an hour, depending on what you have prepared, what you want to say, and how many questions we get. So we will defer to you on timing, and we appreciate you spending the time with us this evening discussing this really exciting research.
I can talk as loud or as long or as short as you want me to. So happy to take questions. Can people see my screen right now?
Yes, we have your screen.
Okay, and it doesn't have any like blank spaces. It's just the slides.
Yes.
Cool. Sometimes with Zoom, it shows like the presenter view, which I didn't want it to do. Feel free to please ask questions during this. I'm not sure what kind of lectures you've all had here before. Gravitational waves are kind of a new and cutting edge field within astrophysics. So happy to stop, move this in. I much prefer conversations than lectures. So please do stop me at any time if you have any questions about anything that I'm saying. But thank you for the nice introduction. Yeah, so my name is Mike Zevin. I'm an astrophysicist at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Talking a little bit about the history of the discovery of gravitational waves, I was fortunate enough to join the LIGO Scientific Collaboration just a few months before the first gravitational wave discovery was made. So I kind of got into the field at a very, very good time for doing this kind of science. And through this talk, I'm just going to be giving you a little bit of background about what gravitational waves are, what kind of objects in the cosmos we're interested in studying and looking at with them, and some of the recent discoveries that we've had. In fact, we more than just a few weeks ago, more than doubled our size of compact object mergers that we've observed with gravitational waves, at least the ones that are announced to the public. So it's a really budding field. It's a really exciting field right now, and it's giving us a whole new way to look at the universe. So as folks here probably know, you know, throughout the history of astronomy, we've really been reliant on one particular sense for observing the cosmos, and that is, you can think of it as the sense of sight, but it's really one messenger from the cosmos, which are electromagnetic waves. So, from when cavemen long ago started looking up at the sky and trying to, map out where particular stars are, understand why certain blips of light are moving relative to the stars, to the invention of the telescope in the early 1600s, we've been getting better and better and better at collecting more and more light from the universe. We're kind of just sitting here, just waiting for this light to reach us, and that's what's telling us about all these processes and objects that are in the cosmos. Of course, the light that we see with our eyes is only a very small part of what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. So, ranging from low energy gamma radio waves to high energy gamma rays. I just noticed for the first time that this says gamma rays. I've given this slide so many times before, and this is the very first time that I noticed it says gamma rays instead of gamma rays. So that's fun. But of course, these are all the same type of information. The light that we see with our eyes, microwaves, ultraviolet light, X-rays, they're all different frequencies of electromagnetic radiation. So we've built telescopes to observe all of these different kinds of radiation, both in the ground and in space. But some things that are very difficult to observe with light are certain objects in the cosmos, such as black holes. So this is not a real picture of a black hole. This is actually from a movie called Interstellar. But it's a realistic physical representation of what a black hole might look like if you were sitting very, very close to it. Interestingly enough, these high-budget Hollywood movies, especially this one in particular, did a fairly good job of representing kind of the bending of light that you would see around a black hole, in this case, a supermassive black hole like this one here. Turns out Hollywood has more monies for their supercomputers than typical astrophysics departments do. And I see, is everything okay with the sound and audio? Just wanted to make sure and check.
Oh yes, well, I put us on mute so that any random hubbub and people stumbling past the microphone to get to the cookies wouldn't be disruptive. But if as people have questions, we'll go ahead and unmute and swing the camera in their direction.
Please, that'd be great.
We
Okay.
are listening raptly, I assure you.
Gotcha. Just making sure. Now, this is obviously an idealized situation of what we could see around a black hole with an accretion disk if it were sitting, right on our doorstep. But we have been able to infer the existence of black holes in many different ways throughout the history of astronomy. Really, the first indirect observation of black holes existing in the universe were through systems called X-ray binaries. These are systems where you have a star that is getting material stolen from it from a hidden compact object that's next to it. So we can essentially tell that the star is orbiting something because of how it moves towards and away from us. And we see that this system is emitting very strongly in X-rays, hence the name X-ray binaries. So observations of these in our Milky Way galaxy and in nearby galaxies have been able to tell us of these stars that are orbiting around this hidden object. And based on how fast it's orbiting, we can tell how heavy that object is, which effectively tells us that it's orbiting a black hole that's sucking up its material and heating it up in X-ray radiation. We're also able to see evidence of a different flavor of black holes, things called supermassive black holes that reside in the centers of most, if not all, large galaxies, through objects that we call quasars, which was an acronym for quasi-stellar radio sources, essentially point sources on the sky that were emitting very heavily in radio frequencies. These we can see out to very high distances in the universe, because these are black holes that are essentially beaming this radiation out of their poles, and something that is incredibly bright and something that we can see to very vast distances. So another indication that there's this massive, dense object that's not only sucking up this material but shooting out material as it does as well. And one of the recent, well. More recent observations indirectly of black holes' existence was observations of the black hole in the galactic center. So we call this black hole Sagittarius A star in the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And for decades, we've been tracking the orbits of bright, massive stars near the center of the Milky Way galaxy, which is a very hard observation to make. But if you time lapse the kind of motion of these stars, you can see that they're all kind of orbiting around some common origin. So you can see the time moving forward in the upper right. And this is one of the best pieces of indirect evidence of a black hole lurking at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And in fact, was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics a few years ago. In fact, by the orbits of these particular stars, we're able to constrain how massive that object that they're orbiting is, that invisible object, and it turns out to be about 4 million times the mass of our sun. In recent years, in the past 5 or so years, we've actually been able to take also direct images of black holes, both in the center of our Milky Way galaxy and in the nearby elliptical galaxy M87. This is probably a picture that many of you have seen before because it was on the news quite a bit back in 2019. This particular black hole in the galaxy M87 was one that was targeted because of how massive this black hole was believed to be, about 6 billion solar masses. So even though it's 50 million light years away, these arrays of radio telescopes were able to have the resolution to image essentially the accretion disk and the shadow of the black hole. We were similarly able to do this for the black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy, albeit at a lower resolution, mostly because since it's a lighter black hole, about 4 million solar masses, these images and the bright spots in the disk vary quite a bit more rapidly. So this intro was kind of just like, what was the state of the field in understanding black holes observationally prior to gravitational waves? And to understand what gravitational waves actually are, it's important to go back and put some context into our understanding of how gravity works in the universe. So this is just an animation showing kind of the idea of what we call Newtonian gravity, but kind of the traditional way that we understand gravity working if we were taught it in grammar school or high school. So gravity is this invisible and instantaneous force at a distance that pulls objects that have mass together. But space and, in fact, time, like the stage that these objects are doing their dance on, is a fixed quantity. It doesn't respond to or change its geometry in the presence of matter or energy. And this ended up causing some issues come turn of the 20th century in the late 1800s and early 1900s, because there were certain aspects of this theory that didn't quite work well with current observations and current physical considerations. I will note, though, that Newtonian gravity is really an unbelievable theory and a huge leap forward for human intelligence, because it was, as far as I know, the first physical theory, the first physical law that connected terrestrial events, things like apples falling from trees or us sticking to our planet Earth and not flying away, to things that are happening in the cosmos as well. So that kind of was a huge leap in our understanding of these fundamental theories of our universe. Now, a couple of the problems that happened with Newtonian gravity, one had to do with very precise observations of solar system objects, in particular, the planet Mercury. So all planets orbit the sun in ellipses, so not perfect circles, but ellipses. This is one of Kepler's famous laws of planetary motion. And Mercury is the most stretched out of all the planets. It has the highest eccentricity of all the planets, if you are, you know, not counting Pluto in the planetary game anymore. And by looking at the orbit of Mercury year after year after year, astronomers were able to tell that the orbit of Mercury was precessing, which means the closest point in this eccentric orbit was rotating around in a circle. And you could count up the effect that all the other objects in the solar system, like Jupiter in particular, since it's the most massive planet, sorry about that, had on the orbit of Mercury. And it only accumulated up to 1.3 degrees per century, but observations were telling us that it was precessing at more like 2 degrees per century. Another problem with Newtonian gravity is it was described as this instantaneous force at a distance. In the kind of development of the theory of electromagnetism in the late 1800s, this turned out to be something that doesn't quite work with this universal speed limit, which is the speed of light. And one kind of thought experiment that I think is fun to think about is, what would happen to our planet Earth if the sun were to suddenly disappear? Now, of course, it would get dark, it would get cold, but how long does it take Earth to actually know that the sun has disappeared? Now, this seems kind of like an irrelevant question because this would never happen, but the fact of the matter is that if you have this universal speed limit at which information can travel, gravity is one of the things that falls under that realm of information. And it would take about 8 minutes, which is the speed, the time it takes light to travel from the sun to the Earth, for Earth to know that the sun has actually disappeared. Not just getting darker, not just getting colder, but also losing the information about its orbit. So Earth would actually continue orbiting this nothingness for 8 whole minutes and then shoot off on a tangent if the sun were to instantaneously disappear. So over a grueling 10 years, Albert Einstein reformulated our understanding of gravity with probably his biggest contribution to science, even though he had many, which is his theory of general relativity. And said very concisely by the late, great John Wheeler, in this theory, space effectively tells matter how to move, and matter tells space how to curve. So space acts and responds to the presence of matter and energy. And the motion of things through space is really just their motion in this kind of curved geometry of space-time itself. Now, this solved all these problems. I'm going to go through this quickly. There was direct observational confirmation of one of the big predictions from this theory just a few years later by Arthur Eddington in the solar eclipse that was visible in South America. So this really like was one of the things that made Einstein rise to this claim of fame, this kind of direct evidence of this general theory of relativity being a true description of how matter and space and time and energy operate on large scales in our universe. Now, just a year after, one of the byproducts of this theory was uncovered, that if you have this malleable fabric of space-time and things are accelerating through this fabric, it actually creates ripples in the fabric of space-time that propagate away from those systems at the speed of light. And these ripples are what we call gravitational waves. So these have been known in theory for about 110 years at this point. And I like to think of it in a simple sense as if you were to drag your hand through a pond of water, you create ripples that emanate away on the surface. Of course, this is a three-dimensional surface that permeates everything, and it's a little hard to think of these in this abstract way. Now, what do these gravitational waves do? They're completely invisible, so you wouldn't be able to see them with a typical telescope that's made to collect light. But as they pass through space, they cause space itself to expand and contract. That's the effect that these waves have. And anything sitting inside of space, like you or me or the planet Earth, also expand and contract with the fabric of space that they're sitting on. So if we imagine that we had some system that was emitting gravitational waves like this, these two black holes going around each other, and these gravitational waves pass through our planet Earth, Earth would actually go through this series of expansions and contractions as well, just like what you're seeing vastly exaggerated in this particular image up here. These are a couple other demonstrations of the effect of a passing gravitational wave. If we were pointing gravitational waves into the screen that you're looking at, or if we were to look at a series of test particles that are just situated in space throughout multiple distances. So I wanted to ask if anyone had any kind of questions about the background science behind gravitational waves before moving on. I don't know if this is something that you've talked about in this group before or not, but that was just kind of the introduction.
Yeah, we do have a couple questions here in the room.
Yeah, please.
Doc, I wonder, what's the frequency of this? Is this a very low frequency or a very high frequency?
They're at, so most of the objects in astronomy in the universe would be emitting these at much lower frequencies than what we're typically used to when we're talking about light. So the frequencies of gravitational waves from things that we believe are happening in the universe span from about 10 to the minus 9, so 1 billionth of a hertz, to a few thousand hertz. So if you know about electromagnetic waves, you know, most electromagnetic waves are at much higher frequencies than that. So extremely long wavelength, low frequency sources.
Amateur VLF couldn't pick this up at all, could it?
I'm sorry?
BLF, it's not electromagnetic.
No, these are a completely different kind of source of information, okay. which is what makes them so interesting, because throughout the entire history of astronomy, we've really been reliant almost entirely on electromagnetic radiation. And this is a completely different sense for understanding objects in the cosmos.
The ones they've detected so far were at the audible. They literally convert it to something that you can hear.
Standard sirens,
audibly. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The Dr. Zevin, I'll ask, one of the animations you had on the previous slide looked an awful lot like the expansion of the universe. That one in particular reminded me a lot of discussing the Hubble's constant expansion, how it isn't localizable. And it made me wonder, I know we're supposed to break our, for the purpose of this discussion, we're supposed to be breaking our reliance on electromagnetics, but I can't help but wonder, wouldn't you still see some effect of light passing through these gravitational perturbations and it would having some sort of blue or red shift effect? Or is it just not enough to be noticeable, or is it wash out when it comes through?
So one thing is, as I'll tell in a little bit, the gravitational waves are incredibly, incredibly, incredibly small perturbations. Okay. So, but I will say that the expansion of the universe itself does affect the gravitational wave signals that we receive here on Earth. They have, you know, a wavelength and a frequency just like electromagnetic radiation does. And they are stretched with the expanding universe as we're looking at things very far away. So they do get redshifted just like light does. From the expanding universe.
Okay. Any other questions from the room or from out in Zoomland?
Okay. I've heard some recent theories where people are speculating that gravitons may actually have a small amount of mass. And that would have, to me, it solves a lot of problems with kind of expansion and the rate in the different readings that we get for Hubble's constant. Do you have any, I mean, looking at the waves as far as graviton detection is as well, do you have any thoughts on that?
So for those that aren't familiar, gravitons are the hypothesized force carrier for the force of gravity. We can actually make some of the best constraints on the graviton mass with gravitational wave observations. And the basic reason for that is if we are able to see a particular event in the cosmos that's emitting both gravitational waves and light, we can constrain the mass of the graviton based on how different these gravitational waves travel relative to the speed of light. So the one observation that we were able to make like this that I'll talk about in a little bit constrained the graviton mass to extremely, extremely, extremely close to zero, if not zero, which would mean that it is a massless particle that does travel at the speed of light.
Right. I've always been taught it's massless, but I've heard some rumblings that it may have some mass, which fundamentally changes a lot of things out there, mm-hmm. even if it's infinitesimal. So I was just curious.
I mean, and you can make huge, really, really good constraints with these types of observations. You can never say that it's not massless, but you can say that it is extremely, extremely, extremely close to massless, because if it were massive, then it would travel at a different velocity than the speed of light.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, when you say Now, so, I mean, comparative to like a neutrino, are we on the same ballpark?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember the exact numbers, but we're thinking way less than, you know, the mass electron. So, could be constraints could be around the neutrino mass. I don't exactly remember how fine the constraints are for the graviton mass.
I'm probably getting off traffic. So
no, it's a great question. So I'll keep going through to get to the fun stuff. So to observe these gravitational waves, like I said, these were known about in theory for over 100 years, but even Einstein himself thought that these were something that we would never be able to use for astronomy, never be able to use for understanding the universe. In the 1960s, people came up with the idea of using laser interferometry as a possible means of detecting these gravitational waves. I'll explain why, you know, these complicated techniques and why Einstein thought that we would never detect them. I'll explain that in just about a second, but let me tell you about these devices first. There are two in the U.S. There's the LIGO detectors in Louisiana and Washington State, as well as sister detectors that aren't quite as strong or sensitive in Italy and one in Japan as well. And they all work together to make observations of these gravitational waves passing through our planet Earth. These detectors are giant L-shaped devices. Each of these arms of this L-shaped device are about 2.5 miles long for the two LIGO detectors. And they're shooting an incredibly high-powered laser down these arms through a vacuum chamber. Now, what this laser is doing is it's using the wave-like properties of light to act as an incredibly, incredibly precise ruler to measure very, very minuscule changes in distances between these two arms. Now, as you might have remembered from before, as a gravitational wave passes through our planet, it causes physical distances to stretch and squeeze because the fabric of space is also stretching and squeezing. And these particular rulers are made to measure exactly that, to measure one of these arms getting a little bit smaller while another one gets a little bit bigger. This is a little bit of a simplified idea of how these work in practice. So you have this laser split down these two arms through a beam splitter. The laser light will bounce off mirrors, the end stations of the arms. In reality, these are actually Fabry-Perot cavities, so the laser light is bouncing around hundreds of times in these tunnels. And if it comes back, when it comes back and recombines, if these arms are exactly the same length, you'll have destructive interference between the light beams in the detector. And if one is a little bit longer than the other, then you'll start to have interference patterns that show up when the light recombines. So like I said, it's really acting like an incredibly precise ruler. Now, the types of objects that we're suited for looking at are what we call compact objects. So these are things like neutron stars and black holes, incredibly, incredibly dense objects in the cosmos. And I'll skip over this very quickly, but part of the reason why we need compact objects, this is an expression for the power emitted from gravitational waves. And for those mathematical aficionados here, you might notice a couple things that are interesting from this. One is that this scales as the mass of the objects divided by their separation to the fifth power, which means that we need things that are very, very heavy that can get very, very, very close together. So two galaxies colliding are very heavy. It's a very heavy collision. But the center, they're not dense enough to be able to create powerful enough gravitational waves for us to detect. The other thing that's absolutely crazy that comes out of this is this combination of physical constants, gravitational constant to the fourth power and speed of light to the fifth power, which if you put in numbers in standard kilometers, so kilograms meter second is a value of about 10 to the minus 83, which is incredibly, 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 incredibly small, which is just telling us that space-time itself is really, 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 really stiff, and you need incredibly energetic things to be able to wiggle space-time enough for us to ever conceivably be able to detect. To give you an idea, you know, Earth going around the sun, it's emitting gravitational waves at a power of about 10 to the 2 watts, so enough to power a light bulb if we were able to capture this. But if you have two merging black holes in the universe, it's emitting gravitational waves at something like 10 to the 52 watts. So 50 orders of magnitude more than this Earth-Sun system. I'm going to skip through this, but what does this actually mean? So how sensitive do we need to be? For a typical merger of black holes out there in the universe, we need to be sensitive to changes in distance between these two arms of something on the order of 10 to the negative 18 meters. So we have these 2.5 mile long arms, and we need to know when one of them changes by a length of 10 to the minus 18 meters. That's a stupidly small number, and to put that into context just a little bit, we'll work our way down from stuff that we know. So all of us as humans are about a meter tall, give or take, working in orders of magnitude here. But if you divide that 1 meter by about 10,000, you get down to about the width of a human hair. The wavelength of visible light is about 1,000 times smaller than that, about 10 to the 6 meters. The diameter of hydrogen atoms is about 10,000 times smaller than that, so an angstrom length, which is about 10 to the minus 10 meters. But atoms are mostly empty space. The nucleus of the atom is much, much smaller, about 100,000 times smaller than the size of the atom itself, 10 to the negative 15 meters. And the distances that we need to be able to access are about 1,000 times smaller than that. So 1,000 times smaller than about the width of a proton is what we need to be sensitive to actually see these things in the universe. I'll skip through this slide. I think there's some interesting things, but just kind of like the history of gravitational waves, I'd be happy to share the PDFs of these slides later. We had great indirect evidence of gravitational wave emission. But through the first decade of the 2000s, these gravitational wave detectors were actually up and running and trying to observe these signals from the cosmos. But in the first decade, from 2000 to 2010, they didn't see anything. Now, that was unfortunate, but it wasn't unexpected based on how often we believed these mergers of black holes and neutron stars were actually occurring in the universe. Between 2010 and 2014, a series of upgrades were made to these detectors. These were planned from the beginning of this mission to make them more sensitive to the gravitational wave universe. So essentially letting them see these things farther and farther out. And in September of 2015, the first run, observing run of these new events began. And yeah, I just saw the question. Yes, very similar to, the old Michelson interferometers, but these are much more kind of sophisticated versions of these interferometers. So the detectors actually turned on for their new run on September 11th, 2015. And pretty amazingly, 3 days later, we saw a blaringly loud signal. This was something that when, you know, I was kind of new into this field at the time, almost everyone thought was a fake test for us to kind of test our infrastructure for, because it was just so loud and so clear. To give you an idea, I mean, people have built these sophisticated data analysis pipelines to search through the gravitational wave data to find these things that are hidden deep below the noise. And this is, you know, people spent their careers doing this kind of stuff. And then the first thing that we saw was so loud that you could just see it with the naked eye in the data, which is pretty unbelievable. What you're looking at here is what we call the strain. This is just a, you know, an infographic, but the basic idea is that the two colors here are the two different detectors, the one in Louisiana and the one in Washington. And the wiggles up and down are essentially encoding how much these two things are stretching and squeezing as these gravitational waves pass by. So one thing that we like to do with gravitational waves is rather than just looking at the... Sorry, did you have someone have a question?
I had a quick question about that.
Yeah.
So you have detectors in two spots and you're kind of looking for similar... Do you do them in two spots? Because I imagine with the sensitivity you're talking about, vibrations like trucks going by or something rambling the earth could affect one. So if you see it in both, that's how you can say you can rule. Is that how you're ruling out any kind of like on-site vibrations?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So these gravitational waves pass right through our planet and don't really care at all. They don't couple to matter. So we would expect to see them in both detectors within 10 milliseconds of each other, which is the maximum light travel time between those two detectors.
Okay.
So but you're totally right. And it's wild what these things pick up, whether it be a truck driving on a road 10 miles away, strong winds, lightning strikes hundreds of miles away can be picked up in these detectors, earthquakes on the other side of the planet, nuclear testing on the other side of the planet. These things are all creating noise within the detectors. But our hope is that essentially that the noise won't be coincident between the two detectors or coherent, not have the same frequency content, but these gravitational waves do. So now that we're further into this field, we're able to actually make confident observations, even when only a single detector sees it, because these detectors sometimes go down for a little bit because of technical issues. But for these first observations, it was crucial to have both detectors to be able to do exactly what you said and rule out these other kinds of terrestrial noises. Yeah, great question. Two detectors, I'll get into that in a little bit, but having multiple detectors, these detectors kind of act like an omnidirectional microphone. So having more than one actually can help you triangulate where these things are coming from in the sky too. And that'll be important in a little bit. So with these particular types of gravitational waves that we're able to observe from the surface of the Earth, these are what we would consider high frequency gravitational waves. I know you might not think that, 50 hertz is very high frequency when it comes to light, but for gravitational waves, those are quite high frequency. And just by some stroke of luck, so are the gravitational waves that we can detect from Earth that are coming from these merging compact objects have frequencies that are very similar to the audible frequency range of humans, which is from around, a few tens to a couple thousands of hertz. So we can literally take the data from gravitational waves, the exact frequencies that we're seeing, and turn it into a sound that we can listen to, which is one of the reasons why people will often use the analogy that we are hearing the universe for the very first time. And I'm not sure if these sounds are going to work. I think I got them to work, but I'm going to play this now. And what we're going to be looking at is a spectrogram, so a time frequency map of this very first event. And you're actually going to be hearing the frequencies from this event as well. So let me know if you can hear this or not.
You can indeed hear it.
Good. So first of all, you might notice this is an incredibly quick event. It happened over about a fifth of a second, which is wild to think about because I'm going to tell you what this event actually was. The first thing that you hear that's kind of like the thumping is just the actual frequencies transformed into audio. And it's pretty low frequencies, so it's hard for our ears to pick up significant differences in the frequencies. The second one that sounds more like a whoop, that's us just taking the frequencies and just shifting everything up by 400 hertz. So making it a little easier for us to hear the frequency evolution of this event. So let's listen to it one more time. Oops. One that's just in frequency. Great. So what is giving us this particular signal? Thankfully, Einstein's relativity does a great job of describing what these waveforms, what these wiggles will look like for merging compact objects in the universe. And we have sophisticated techniques that essentially give us an idea of how heavy these things are, how far away they are, how fast these black holes are even spinning. So through a procedure called parameter estimation, we're able to take this data and get kind of like an estimate of our best guesses of what these particular objects are. And we can do a pretty darn good job with this. So it turns out that this very first event was caused by the collision of two black holes. These two black holes were about a billion light years away. So this is actually something that happened a billion years in the past, since gravitational waves travel at the speed of light. And that whole fifth of a second signal is something that we're simulating right here, slowing it down significantly. But what we're catching is the last 5 to 10 orbits of these two black holes as they're going around each other. They're losing energy through the emission of gravitational waves. So their orbit is shrinking because of this energy loss. And then these black holes eventually merge and form a bigger black hole. These two black holes were both about 30 times the mass of the sun, so much, much heavier than our sun for both of these. And like I said, this is an incredibly slowed down view. You know, the background stars are there for, you know, for artistry of this, but the bending of light around these particular black holes, as well as their evolution around each other, is something that's using the real physics from what we measured in this particular signal. Like I said, this is incredibly slowed down. This is more like what this would look like. In fact, this is still about five times too slow, which is wild because these are both things that are 30 times heavier than the sun that are moving at these speeds that are very close to the speed of light, significant fractions of the speed of light right before they merge. And this is why they're emitting strong enough gravitational radiation for us to detect. Now, one thing I love about black holes is that these things are actually incredibly small objects relative to their mass. The final merger product of that black hole is only a couple hundred kilometers across. So I've placed it on top of Canada here. So you can see just how tiny this thing that's over 60 times more massive than the sun actually is. One of the amazing things about this that I love to share as well is that these two black holes that collided for this first event, like I said, they're each about 30 times the mass of the sun, but to give you a little bit more precise numbers, one was measured to be 29 times more massive than the sun, and the other was 36 times more massive than the sun. But the final merger product here was 62 times more massive than the sun. So if you do a little math in your head, 29 plus 36 doesn't equal 62. There's three solar masses lost during this collision. That's actually lost to the energy that's emanating away from these gravitational waves that are being emitted. And people might know, you know, E equals mc squared. This is Einstein's famous mass energy equivalence. Three solar masses of pure energy is a ridiculous, ridiculous amount of energy that's being contained in these gravitational waves. In fact, if you were to take all that energy and use it to power a light bulb, that light bulb would outshine every single star in the observable universe during this collision. So incredibly, incredibly energetic events, but not emitting light. They're depositing their energy into the fabric of space-time itself.
Can we interrupt for a quick question?
Please.
So you said that you had a few days into the data run, this signal was detected, but that also people had done a lot of effort to go back and analyze data to figure out if find things that were otherwise lost in the noise. If we were only able to detect it naked eye looking at the signal for that fifth of a second, that means an awful lot of energy was released at that moment, but presumably more energy was released in the time leading up to it. About how far did people do their analysis to figure out how far back it was actually detectable now that we knew what to look for there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way that we actually do, so when you can't see it with the naked eye thing was just like a kind of fun fact of, you know, we were able to detect this with just the naked eye. But in reality, what we do is, since we have such a good idea of what these signals should look like based on Einstein's relativity, we develop hundreds of thousands of templates, essentially, for black hole mergers of different, you know, mass combinations and spins and whatnot. And we use these to scan through the data in a process that we call match filtering. That's kind of the main way that we look for these things within the data itself. This particular signal, the thing is, the early wiggles are much less powerful than the later wiggles. So as you get closer and closer to the merger, the power emitted in gravitational waves grows significantly. I think it's to the power of, to like, something like to the fifth power with the distance between these two objects. So you can, you know, if you looked at this, for example, and you imagine putting a template on this, eventually you just get lost in the noise. So the power is just so small that it's not any different from the typical noise fluctuations that we have. But that is, I mean, effectively, when we're trying to estimate properties of the system, we are using these much longer templates that are picking up some information from this region before But for this particular system, I mean, you're not going to get much information more than a second before the merger, because the gravitational waves are just so weak, even that close to merger. You really need these last few cycles when the black holes are very, very, very close to each other.
Yes. No, thank you for that. It kind of speaks to what you were talking about earlier with how the units boil out when you were calculating the EDT. We have another question in the room.
I was just wondering how many events have been detected so far.
Great question. Can you hold that for like 5 minutes? Because I'll get there.
Sorry, we'll go back to listen.
No, this is a super good question. So moving back forward again, I wanted to highlight one other event that we saw in 2017. This one, you'll notice some stark differences when I play this one. Here we have three rows because the Italian detector was online for this as well as the two ones in the US. So this one takes a little longer, but I'll start things off. Now, one thing you can tell right away is that this is happening over a significant longer period of time. So we're getting many more cycles, kind of what we were just speaking to. You might not hear anything just yet, but I'll be quiet now so you can hear kind of the end part of this signal. So this was happening over a much longer period of time. It reached much higher frequencies. I didn't do any artificial shifting of the frequencies for this particular one. This is the true audio analog of what these gravitational wave frequencies were. And the reason that this just seems quite a bit different than the one that we heard before is because this wasn't the merger of two black holes. It was actually the merger of two neutron stars. This is kind of the other prime type of object that we thought we might be able to detect with these gravitational waves. Neutron stars are the remnant cores of massive stars. They're about the size of a city, so 10 miles or so across, so incredibly small astronomically speaking, but way more than the entire sun. So it's the densest, most extreme form of matter that we know about in the universe. I show a comparison of a neutron star size over the city of Chicago, because that's where I'm from. But to just give you some idea of just how incredibly dense these particular objects are, if you were to take a spoonful of neutron star dirt and weigh it on a scale here on Earth, that one spoonful of dirt would weigh more than an entire mountain. These are matter packed at the most dense possible densities you can ever imagine. But the great thing about neutron stars, unlike black holes, when two neutron stars collide, it's not a completely invisible collision. The tidal forces between these two neutron stars actually rip each other apart and spew out this extremely dense matter into the universe. And this was long predicted to cause a couple of very bright explosions in space. First, it was expected to cause something called a kilonova, which is essentially a radioactive cosmic explosion, and as well as a gamma ray burst, so a burst of high energy gamma ray radiation. So when this event was detected, telescopes all over the world searched the region of the sky that we were able to triangulate it to. So back to the triangulation thing, with one detector, we'd be completely useless. With two, we can constrain it to kind of like a banana shape in the sky. And with three, we can pin it down even more so. This is still a humongous area of the sky to be looking at with research-grade telescopes. So telescopes all over the world and in space were scouring this region of the sky. I should note that there was also a gamma ray detection about 1.7 seconds later. So this was clear that this was coming from, that these things were coincident, they were happening because of the same astronomical event. And actually, Richard, to your question on the graviton, these two observations here are one of the most stringent constraints that we have on the graviton mass, because we see light coming from this event about 1.7 seconds after the gravity comes from this event. And this thing traveled about, what was the distance? About 200 million light years. So the fact that these came to us so close together in time is an indication that these things are traveling at nearly the exact same speed. And there are astrophysical processes that can cause the light to come a little bit after the gravity. So
is that how you're constraining it? Because if graviton has mass, it can't travel at speed of light. It has to be slower.
Exactly. Yep.
Okay, so you can figure out that delta. Okay.
Yep. Exactly. And that's why we have such good constraints on the graviton mass from these observations. And about 10 hours later, after lots of scouring, optical telescopes were actually able to find the explosion that was associated with this, something that we call a kilonova explosion. This was long hypothesized to be something that was created when two neutron stars merged, but we were actually able to find the coincident explosion, which is shown here in the upper right relative to its host galaxy, whereas 20 days before, surveys didn't find this high luminosity explosion there. This video is like way too loud, and I'm gonna skip it because I'll let it go. But you might want to turn the volume. NASA likes to make very we'll see. I'll skip past this because oops, and I said I'd skip past it, then I went back to it. They tend to make very over-the-top visualizations with these big astronomical discoveries. But this blue area here is representing what we call the kilonova explosion. You're imagining this incredibly neutron-rich, high-density material being flung out into space that will cause things to emit through radioactive decay. But one of the things that happens in these explosions, too, is that you actually get very efficient formation of heavy elements from these types of explosions. And in fact, we didn't know where many of the heaviest elements in the periodic table came from. There were thoughts that they came from these types of events, but we never confirmed it until this particular event. And this one merger of these two neutron stars that we saw actually yielded about 200 times the Earth's mass in gold. So things like gold and silver and uranium and platinum that we have here on Earth, we believe actually originated from these collisions that happened deep in the history of the cosmos. So someone was asking in the room where we are now. This is a figure that we like to show in talks, but this is essentially, this is a little bit more than where we were before gravitational waves were discovered as far as our knowledge of compact objects in the universe. My Zoom is covering the legend, but this is showing the black holes and the neutron stars that we've known about via indirect observations. So essentially seeing signals of them electromagnetically through X-ray binaries or other types of things. The first gravitational wave catalog that we released in 2017 found maybe a dozen or so, including that double neutron star merger. What we're looking at in this plot here is just the masses of the compact objects on the vertical axis, and the horizontal axis doesn't have any meaning whatsoever. It's just for display. But for each one of these gravitational wave events, we have two black holes that are merging into a bigger one, which is at the end of the arrow here. The second catalog that we released increased this substantially. Third catalog even more so, and the most recent catalog, which was from the first third of our current observing run, was just released a few weeks ago and more than doubled what we had so far. So this is an exponentially growing field, partially because of every time we turn the detector off at the end of a run, a series of upgrades are made to make it more sensitive to the universe. We're accessing a larger volume of the universe with each one of these new runs. So this was only a third of the ones that we found in this current run. So you can expect this plot to be even more congested in about a year or so when we release the next couple catalogs. You'll notice, too, that the black holes that we're seeing from out there in the universe, many of them are much more massive than the ones that we've inferred existence of in the Milky Way galaxy, too. So this is kind of the family portrait of all the things that we've had released to the public so far, these 200 or so events colored by the different observing runs that they were detected in. And quickly, because I know we're running short on time, I'm going to skip past my personal research interests and things like that. If people are interested, they can let me know. But just to move on to what the future is going to look like, which is right here. So this is showing the number of gravitational wave events as a function of time. The y-axis here is logarithmically scaled, which means that it's spaced evenly between 1 and 10 and 100. And these things on the far right are future detectors that are going to be initiated for observing these gravitational waves. So let's kind of move forward in time in this cumulative distribution. The black are showing the number of black holes, and then these error bars are based on projections from what we know the rates to be. One of the really cool things with gravitational waves is, since we're measuring wave amplitudes rather than fluxes like we do with traditional telescopes, our sensitivity increases by a factor of 2, our reach also increases by a factor of 2. So another way to say that is that the strength of one of these gravitational waves decreases linearly with distance, whereas with light, since we're measuring flux, essentially, we're measuring power, it decreases as 1 over the distance squared, which is something we might know from astronomy. All that means is that as we build more sensitive detectors, we're quickly not just finding more, but we're really accessing all of the events that are happening in the entire universe. In the 2030s and early 2040s, we're literally going to be going from seeing the first black hole 30 years ago in this method to seeing every single one that's merging in the entire universe. So going from tens to hundreds, which is where we're at right now, to millions in the next 20 years.
A question. When you're showing your chart, and it kind of ties into that, all the black hole mergers that you saw were all on your chart, kind of the solar mass level ones that were, from massive binary pair stars.
Mm-hmm.
Have you detected any of supermassive black hole mergers from merging galaxies? Because obviously you'd be able to detect it from sensitivity, and it's obviously a much rarer event. We just haven't been like lucky enough for that to happen at the time that we needed to happen?
Yeah, great question. In fact, the reason that supermassive black holes aren't shown in this is because the gravitational wave detectors that I was talking about through this talk, these ones that are on the surface of the Earth, they aren't able to see those kinds of signals.
I was wondering about that too. Is it just too much almost? Because
so the frequencies that we're sensitive to are about 10 hertz. In gravitational wave frequencies, 10 hertz to a couple thousand hertz. And the frequency is directly related to the orbital period of these two things going around each other. Okay. For very heavy supermassive black holes, we believe these things are merging on the universe, but they're at frequencies much lower than 10 hertz. Because their orbital periods are so much larger before they collide with one another.
I got you. Okay, that makes sense. So even though the energy output is enormous, that's not the constraint. It's the actual frequency, because they're not as close together when they finally come together.
Exactly, and they are emitting gravitational waves. Actually, that set us up perfect for this.
It has to be. Yeah.
Set us up perfect for this last slide right here. So these terrestrial interferometers, which are the first ones to observe gravitational waves, they're limited by our planet itself, because the Earth is rumbling and grumbling, and there's just so much noise below about 10 hertz that there's not much more that we can do to be sensitive to lower frequency gravitational waves. But just like light comes in many different frequencies and many different wavelengths, so do gravitational waves. And the mergers of supermassive black holes are expected to happen at these much lower frequencies, things like 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 3 or so in terms of gravitational wave frequencies. And the European Space Agency, with contributions from the US, are currently building this kind of next generation thing called LISA, which is going to be effectively a much bigger gravitational wave detector in space. So it's not going to be good for seeing these small black hole mergers, like the things that are 10 to 100s of solar mass, but it'll be extremely good at seeing supermassive black hole mergers in the universe. So you're exactly right. And this is just like these things are kind of like, the first telescope that Galileo pointed in the sky. It's really the first thing that we're using to look at this entire new spectrum of information from the universe. But there are going to be other things that are going to be, looking at the other wavelengths of gravitational waves that are sensitive to different physical phenomena in the universe. Yeah, you set that up perfectly. So thank you for the good question.
You're welcome. So you're actually going to be able to detect from icy pulsars and supernova. I mean, well, pulsars are naturally regularly occurring, but supernova.
Yeah, so the pulsar
with gravitational waves give us a bigger heads up that the supernova, because I know usually we know that they're happening because we see the neutrinos first, and that's when we go, oh shoot, let's look, supernova is about to happen. But the gravitational wave should come before the neutrinos. We might get a split, like, I mean, we're talking fractional milliseconds probably.
I was gonna say it's gonna be a very small amount of time, and we don't, so right now what we've seen are these compact binary inspirals and mergers. That's what we've been able to see so far. The ground-based detectors, and also this is my last slide, so people can feel free to like think about or ask any questions, but these ground-based detectors, some of the other things that we might be sensitive to are pulsars that have that aren't completely spherically symmetric. So a pulsar that's a perfect sphere that's rotating wouldn't emit gravitational waves, but since pulsars have magnetic fields, they can lift up these minuscule mountains that are actually quite dense. And as that pulsar rotates, we're able to see gravitational waves from the that mountain essentially spinning around.
I wouldn't expect a pulsar to be perfectly spherical because they're spinning so fast. So wouldn't that cause some kind of elongation?
So the weird thing with gravitational waves, you need to have a time-varying quadrupole moment, which is completely jargon, but the way that I like to think about it. The way that I like to think about it, if something has a shadow, if you were casting a shadow on it and that shadow changes over time, it emits gravitational waves. If you had a pulsar, even if it was stretched out like this and rotating, it wouldn't be emitting gravitational waves. But if you had one little piece of the pulsar that was sticking up more than the others and rotating around, that would emit gravitational waves.
Okay.
Yeah. And then supernovae, we expect supernovae to be asymmetric. The problem is with current models, probably the only way that we could currently see gravitational waves from supernovae are if they happened in the Milky Way. Just we're not that sensitive to things much farther away, and supernovae only go off in the Milky Way once every 50 to 100 years. So we just would have to get really lucky to have one happen in the next few years.
I'm wondering, going back to the pulsar one, so the surface of the pulsar is going to be fairly smooth because gravity is so strong. But I know that there are sometimes tweaks, and that's what kind of causes, isn't that what magnetars tend to be, where there's small perturbations on that surface, and that's causing the insane, kind of distortions in the magnetic field, and you get the magnetar.
Yeah, or like the so crust of the pulsar. Yeah, but yeah, these little tiny mountains I'm talking about, I mean, these mountains on a pulsar can be, you know, centimeters or inches tall, and they're really just controlled by the strong magnetic field lines coming out of the pulsar itself. So these are one of the sources that we're actively looking for from known pulsars in the Milky Way as well.
Gotcha.
But yeah, I mean, I realize we've been over an hour, and sorry for going long, but there have been some great questions along the way. I'm happy to stick around for another 5-10 minutes and answer any questions that people might have about all of this.
No, we appreciate that. We've got at least a few in the room. Go ahead, Jeff.
How many instruments or stations do you think you need to add to better get an understanding of the spectrum of events that are happening? Because I see we're adding more, but how many do you need? Because I'm coming from a meteorologist standpoint. Obviously, more weather instruments, better data. We don't have many instruments over the oceans with remote sense, but in this way, how many more would help us understand what's going on?
So that's a really good question. So first of all, we would need, I mean, the best thing to have is have multiple instruments that are at the same sensitivity. So the two in the US are significantly more sensitive than the one in Italy and the one in Japan right now. So it's, we have detected some in three. Ideally, well, other than making them more sensitive, which there are ideas for, and I can go into that in a little bit, but ideally we would want to have three or four at perfect places on the planet, because the big thing that having multiple allows us to triangulate these things better in the sky. So even with three detectors observing an event, we're still constraining it to tens, maybe hundreds of degrees in the sky, which, you know, there's about a little over 40,000 degrees in the sky. So that seems great. But when you tell that to an optical astronomer, they're like, are you freaking crazy? How am I supposed to look at 100 square degrees on the sky? So, so having more of them, the best thing that that's doing is triangulating it better in the sky.
And just a quick follow-up to that, do you think, I know we're only 10 years into observing these events, so this is I should ask this question 20, 30 years from now, but have there been anyone talking about how many of these events normally happen in a year? Is there a normal that's being talked about?
As in the whole universe?
Yes.
Great question. The current estimates are that these things are happening about every minute in the universe, something like that, on that kind of basket. In the observable universe. And I was going to say, to your point, these CE and ET, these are what we are calling next generation detectors. So these are going to be the successors to LIGO in the mid-2030s or 2040s. Cosmic Explorer is the US one, and Einstein Telescope ET is the European one. Cosmic Explorer, the plans are for it to be similar to LIGO, but instead of being 4 kilometers on each arm, it's going to be 40 kilometers. Which is a huge engineering and technical challenge in its own right. The U.S. actually has like a lot of empty space that could have this, but at those distances, you actually need to be cognizant of finding topographical places that offset the curvature of the Earth. So you need to find natural kind of bowls on the Earth to be able to set these kinds of things up. But these ones are going to be effectively detecting almost all the black hole mergers happening in the universe.
So would the LISA detectors come online first before these other ones, before these Earth-based ones?
Yes.
And if so, obviously you'd probably put them at some type of Lagrange point. So if you did that, would you have two different LISA detectors at two different Lagrange points?
Great question. Yeah, the LISA detectors are planned to happen before. These are space-based detectors, like I said. So instead of having them at Lagrange points, they're actually going to be... So it's unlike the LIGO ones, it's actually in a triangle configuration. So each one of the arms between these triangles is about a million miles. And this is allowing us to see the frequencies that we're interested for this. So these things like 10 to the minus 6 gravitational wave frequencies. I don't have a video of it here, but you should look up the orbit for the LISA interferometer. It's one of the coolest kind of orbital configurations I've seen, where it's in an Earth trailing orbit, I believe, but it's doing this kind of weird rotation that allows it to maintain its stability over, you know, many orbits around the sun. So I don't know the exact name of what that orbit is called, but it's a super interesting kind of location for it, as well as the orbit is really, really cool. But yeah, LISA's planned as of now for the mid-2030s, so think 10 years from now or so, but of course things can always be pushed back as they are in astronomy.
Any other questions for Dr. Zepp?
A little bit of a brag. Guido Mueller asked me if I could be one of his electrical engineers a couple of years ago for LISA. He's over in Germany.
I'm sorry.
My old optics professor is over in Germany. Heading up the project for LISA, part of the project. And asked me, he's like, I could use an engineer. It's like, I'll have worked on his crane since you showed your test bench. Sorry.
Yeah, and I'm not an instrumentalist by any means of the word. I mean, some of the technology that they've put in these detectors, such as, I mean, now we do this thing called quantum squeezing, which is essentially taking advantage of the uncertainty principle in light to improve the sensitivity of the detectors, which is absolutely wild. I do more of the astrophysical modeling of these types of sources and things like that, which I like, but the instrumentation that goes into this and the engineering is pretty unbelievable.
Do you still get used to the citizen science work that I saw on your website?
Yeah, I do. I developed a project called Gravity Spy, which actually to some of the questions that were asked earlier, this project is using volunteers from the general public to look at actual data from the LIGO detectors. But rather than looking for astrophysical signals like black holes merging, it's looking at all the noise that encounters these detectors. So everything from suspensions in the mirrors vibrating to strong gusts of wind to earthquakes on the other side of the world to electrical, you know, things from the like the AC power frequency are all creating visible noise within these detectors, and understanding that is really important for improving the sensitivity. So if anyone's interested in looking at some of this data, it's at gravityspy.org. So it's one of these projects that are using people from the broad public to help do data analysis to improve the detectors.
Bringing that on board. Any other questions for Dr. Devin? Dr. Devin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We hope to get somebody who is actually out there doing the science and pushing the boundaries of our understanding. It's inspirational so that we know how much more is going on there. As much as we all enjoy explaining to people that Pluto is not a planet and showing them the moon like we're going to be doing this upcoming Saturday, it's really thrilling to know that we're still pushing the limits of what we know and what we can know. So thank you very much for joining us tonight and sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and it was a lot of fun. So, hope all the best to everybody, and feel free to email me if people have any kind of follow-up questions down the road.
Outstanding. Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
Now, that is going to be tough for us to follow.
I'm going to turn the light back on here.
All right. So, and also thank you to Richard for getting that set up and suggesting the topic. Thank you very much. And if anyone else has any recommendations for great lecture topics, possible lecturers to have join us, please don't be afraid to let me know. We can reach out to them and see what we can find out. So that's awesome. That said, it is 8:43. I don't think we ever managed to get through a meeting in 17 minutes, but we're going to try. I do, however, ask that for the remaining reports, including my own nonsense, we keep it quick. So with that said, Jeff, I'm going to turn it over to you.
I'm going to untangle myself on this.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I've got activities for, including some for next year. Let me see if I can find my screen. Here it is right here.
Out of respect for the clock, we probably want to focus on October, November.
Yeah, I'll just cover October. You guys can look at November. How's that? Here we are at the club meeting. We've got Saturday, Sunday on the 4th, which everybody knows about. That's when we look at the sun on Saturday. It's why we call it that. International Observation of the Moon night was humming and hawing around. We finally got that nailed down, thanks to Jeremy, to the boardwalk. So if you'll come to the boardwalk, and that should be all set up and starts at 6. So I'm not sure where the moon exactly is going to be, what phase it is. Probably going to be near full, isn't it?
Yeah.
And this should tell you that. I don't know. Is it almost full? Yeah, almost full. Okay. Wax and gibbous. All right. The next one is Science Night in Sci-Fi. I don't recall what that is. I'm going to look at it real quick. And that is science fiction, especially about the movie Contact at the Chesapeake Public Library, Greenbrier Library. I don't know if we have anybody set up for that, but I will put the word out again.
I'll be the one for presenting for that. So
okay.
Probably about a 45-minute talk inside talking about the real science that is alluded to in science fiction books and movies, in this case focusing on Contact.
Yeah.
And then we'll go out onto their front porch and do some observing for anybody who's interested in that move from Central Library to the Greenbrier Library, because the librarian facilitated it, got transferred to a different branch, and no one wanted to keep going Central.
Okay, very good. Rain and Science is coming up. That's on Saturday. I'm planning on going to that. some STEM activities, and I can't remember where it's located. ODU Planetarium. So it's going to be a big event. Need some volunteers for that. Let me run this to the next one. And let's see. Hornland, Skywatch, that's at Northwest River Park. Harvest Fest, don't know much about it. You know anything about Harvest?
Yeah, so that's Harvest Fest is the banner event for Chipotle State Park. It's their big Harvest Festival. They've been doing it every year for 12 years now. They this time invited us if we wanted to participate and kind of a, hey, you want to help us out considering how much they do for us with Night Watch and supporting us with East Coast Star Party. We said, of course, we'd be thrilled to. So we'll bring solar telescopes, have a tent and a table set up so that we can hide from the sun except for when we're showing it off. Even if you don't have a solar telescope, please feel free to come out. You can spot those people who do. Help show off the sun. It's a great, it's a blast of an event just to attend on its own, and it should be a lot of fun to participate. As presenters at, usually they have 2,000 to 3,000 people at it, so lots of folks to show off a really active sun.
And if you go, I'm planning on going myself, you can scurry back to Skywatch at Northwest River Park, which is a big outreach for us. Chaos. What's going on with Chaos? That's right, Stanton River Falls Star Party. And I haven't ever been to that. It's supposed to be really, really good. So we'll talk about it when we have more time. Let's see. Corn Watch, Night Watch, Chip Oaks, the standard thing. Garden Stars again at 28. I think they canceled. Did they cancel yesterday?
The one from last week was canceled. Oh, the one from last night.
That's right.
We had a blast.
Shrine by the River. I can't remember what that was. Harbor's Edge Retirement Home. Yeah. We're going to try to do that short presentation and see what we can do with that one.
That's right.
Rooftop Astronomy. See, all these events, we really need you guys to volunteer. I'm going to quite a few of them, but I can't go to all of them. Fridays are out for me. So I just want to, I'm giving you guys my pitch.
This is
come to these outreach events.
This is at the rooftop bar again. So again. Astronomy and beer. It's in Ghent. So last time we thought, oh, we'll do it on a dark night. It was a terrible idea because there's way too much light pollution. We can't see anything other than the moon. So we scheduled it on a night when there's a moon. We could point out the moon, maybe some planets and some bright stars. Should be great.
Okay. So that's all I'm going to cover for today. And we'll turn it back over to, who's next, Rich?
Should be Rich.
Okay. I'll stop sharing.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Okay. All right. Treasurer's report.
Muted.
We can't hear you, Rich.
We're not hearing you, Rich.
maybe I should unmute.
Hi, Sandy.
All right. So we got almost $11,000 in across all of our accounts. That is a decrease of $380 from the previous month because we spent almost $1,700 this month and we brought in over $12,000, $1,300. So there was a lot going on. Most of it was related to East Coast Star Party, as well as some other big club purchases, like the big ass sign, if you were at the Star Party, that Sean got, and well as the hot dog machine, which was awesome. So yeah, we brought in a lot, and then we bought stuff for the dew heater workshop. So there's a lot of activity. We gained 3 members in the month to come at 197. I was going to say, oh yeah. And speaking of the East Coast Star Party, Jeremy will like to know that we finished in the black. We finished with $11.05. $11.05. So it was perfection. That's exactly what we wanted to do. We don't want to make money on this, but, we don't want to lose it either. So,
So if Ken had shown up, we would have been able to support the hot dogs.
We would have lost money.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
No, that's great news. Thank you. Thank you, Rich. Any questions on the treasurer?
What was the number of people that showed up for the Friday night? Yeah, at East Coast.
We never got an official number, but they said approximately 60.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions? Entertain a motion to accept the treasurer's report.
Seconded.
Good enough.
Moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Accepted by acclamation. All right. Thank you, Rich. Gabe, do you have any major highlights to hit? I'm going to recommend we waive.
Really, the only thing of note was the special presentation, which was on JPL and the communication with spacecraft, which was by Dr. Lee Torgerson. It was a really great presentation. They've been doing so. Kudos to Jeremy and the other club members for getting some amazing guest speakers to talk about. But that's really all I have of note. Everything else is pretty much just business as usual. Everything else will be covered in the whole new business.
It's all the folks in here who are getting us the good speakers. I just call them or ask people to call them. So
move to accept the minutes.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
All right, Bruce. Excellent. Thank you. All right. Bruce, anything from Alcor?
Yes. Can you hear me okay? And can I share?
If it's quick.
Okay. So I'm just going to hit the top three squares here for the Astronomical League. The International Observe the Moon Night has already been covered. There is a specific challenge that is currently underway for the International Observe the Moon Night. You need to submit by November 11th. This is described on the Astronomical League website. You need to make observations between October 2nd to October 11th, and you have to observe certain features that are described here. So perhaps you can do that on October 4th, and the different MARAE that you need to record are either with your telescope or even visually are listed there. The other challenge currently underway is the T Corona Borealis Observing Challenge, but Rich Roberts will have to wait yet another couple of months because we are still waiting. So anyway, that one's pretty simple. Observe before and after the blow up. Second thing they've got on the site is the RASC, Royal Astronomical Society of Canada handbook, which is a really good summary of a lot of astronomical topics. And they're also selling calendars for 2026. Also on the site is the October night sky chart, which is very useful for outreach. And lastly, I think I already covered this in the August and September meetings I attended, but the Reflector magazine has our awardees that have won different pins already. This is the June edition. And I think we've already covered the awardees from last meetings. It was Jonathan Sheets and Ben Loyola. Okay. So I'm still waiting for the September edition to come out. Once that comes out, then we'll go over who won pins in November. Thanks. That's all I have.
Thanks, Bruce. Do you have anything from the East Coast Star Party side?
Thanks to everybody that attended. I counted the sheets. There were about 30 attendees. I had a great time. I know everybody else did. Next order of business, which we should not cover tonight, and we'll do it by email, is to coordinate with Mr. Trevor Johnston for the March or April 2026 dates for the East Coast Star Party. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you, Bruce. Okay, I'm going to skip over observing reports for tonight. We'll circle back around to them if we have time. As far as items for old business, just to quickly summarize, we do have materials for the Dew Heater Workshop. We did a few Dew Heater Workshops at the East Coast Star Party. If there are folks that really want to build some Dew Heaters, and this is Dew Heater time, please let me know so we can figure out what the right time to schedule one of those events are. I can also just randomly throw something on the calendar, but I'd prefer to know who I'm trying to schedule, especially since I'm probably doing this in my garage / driveway, so I can get an idea of how many people to expect. Bruce alluded to the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada's handbook. I put something out on the monthly update this past month. There is a bulk buy option that if a club wants to put in an order, minimum of 10, we can get $26, and that includes shipping, rather than $28 plus you pay shipping. So far, I have 8 people who've reached out to me that are interested. So I need a few more. If we get that, hit that threshold, I'm planning on putting in the order on Monday. So please, if you're interested, let me know. It looks like we have 9. I hear 9. Do I have 10? 10? 10? So please let me know just by Monday.
We'll, you got George.
I do have George on here. We have we put something on the web store to so that you can pay via PayPal or some such. We'll put that on there. But please let me know that's coming so I know how many to order. You did put that live, Sean, or have you not quite gotten that yet?
You could just use the last link.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
Other. So Rich knows what it's for. Whatever the BBS store, use this when you're directed to. You're being directed to use that link.
Okay. There we go. Patrick, was that a 2? Like you want 2 copies? Okay, so we've hit 10. So, yeah, by Monday, please let me know. It's a great handbook. I will admit I absolutely use it when I'm compiling the list of cool things to observe, but there's a lot more cool things to observe in there. I meant to bring it and forgot. Okay. The other item is, as we discussed, International Observe the Moon Night is going to be the Virginia Beach Oceanfront. The City of Chesapeake initially approved us, but we're not able to use the planetarium area for a variety of reasons, mostly logistical. So we're moving to the oceanfront. We will be getting some parking passes. If we have few volunteers, then we will be able to park at the parking spot for the Surf Rescue Museum. If we have more people than that, we'll be able to use those zones to onload, offload, and then we'll go shuttle ourselves over to the nearby parking garage. We cannot, repeat, cannot park on the boardwalk. It is likely that we will get ticketed because we can only do that when we have permission from the events people. Any questions on any of that? Great. On a related to old business, I'm not sure if David Fontani is on there. There was a shout out for the hot dog machine. It was a great success at the East Coast Star Party. David actually bought a hot dog machine and donated it to the club. So now we don't have the ability to have 18 hot dogs. We have the ability to have 36 hot dogs. So one for Kent and one for everyone else. So thank you, David. I just wanted to recognize you for that, both your assistance with the extra hot dog machine and all the help that you and Andrea did getting us set up and taken down at the Star Party. So thank you for that. I'm going to open the floor to new business, if anybody has any.
Okay. You mentioned the East Coast Surf Party meal plan in the agenda you gave me. So
I did.
I was going to start with that.
Sean, did you want to discuss that? Especially since we were only $11 in the bar.
Refresh my memory.
The meal plan idea?
No, you're right.
Or do you want to defer that to a
We to can another? Defer. All right. We have 2 minutes.
All right. Yeah, we'll defer that one.
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. In that case, we have time for observing reports. Anybody have any good ones?
Time's up.
No, nope, I still have a minute by that clock.
That would be able to.
It's not slow. It's 9 o'clock.
That's the one that we can't. We follow by. No. Okay. Door prize.
All right. So here's awkward thing. The door prize tonight
is a prompt.
It's a. We're drawing for an IOU. Would you like to tell us what the
prize
IOU
is?
Questo.
Not Palomar tells, but the promise is that we'll have an adapter for cell phones to hook up to your telescope, and it's not a plastic one, it's a heavy duty with a case, and of course I didn't bring it, I apologize, but I will get it to the winner, I promise.
We didn't get coffee tonight either, so
we didn't try. Did Irene win last month? So I'm going to let her draw a ticket for tonight. Last 2 minutes are.
Two, three, four.
Missed by 1. All right. Yay. Good job. I also would like to say we've got some new faces in the room. Just Norm
we're trying to be better about not asking people to stand up and introduce themselves, because this is not the sort of club that people are known for their social graces. Few individuals accepted, but welcome. We're glad to have you. Feel free to stop and chat with us. I'd like to think we're a pretty good group, and there's a lot of events that we just went over very quickly for things that we can do that are a lot of fun. If you have questions about those, wondering whether those are things that you can or should get involved in, the answer is yes, because they're a blast. Even if you're just starting your astronomical journey, you know more about astronomy than most members of the public do, and you could be a huge boon, and it's just a lot of fun. That's why it's worth doing. So with that said, standing by to chat with anybody who would like to, but I think we want to go ahead and call it for the evening. I will entertain a motion to adjourn if anyone would like to offer one.
I offer a motion to adjourn.
We have a motion. Second, all in favor?
Aye.